So the nativity, it's done, it happened, successful?
Oh, it happened. It was successful as far as a five-year-old says, yeah, it's good. And you're like, well, give me a little bit more. Because we're getting a video to watch, but we haven't got it yet.
Oh, you haven't seen it yet?
We haven't seen it yet because they obviously, I think from what I hear, it's suddenly big business to go into schools and record the nativity because parents can't go in.
Oh, right. So companies are actually, that's their thing for this sort of season.
Their thing for this season. So I can't imagine it's being edited in terms of people are being taken out of it. Can you imagine if the teacher said, well, if we could lose, I don't know, rock number one and cow number three wasn't quite on it today. And I think if we could just tweak a little bit of Joseph, we'd be fine. So I think, I mean, I imagine it's just top and tailing it.
Sure. Yeah. And some credits.
And sending it
Why
out.
Why not?
A few credits.
Few graphics.
But we don't have it yet. So every day, what graphics are you putting on a nativity?
I don't know. What? Like a whoosh or something? What? Some noise and sound effects?
A whoosh. Here we go. So every day the boys come out and they say, have you got it? Have we watched it yet? And I say, well, no, I haven't got it. And they said, but the school is sending you a link. I'm not sure they know what a link is. It's just a sentence they know.
Yeah.
The school is sending you a link. And I'm like, I haven't got a link yet. And they're a little bit sort of like, when are you going to watch it? But from the accounts of 2 5-year-olds, they apparently, Shepherd One and Wise Man One performed their line. It was clear. No one really went rogue and everyone was pretty good. So that's all I can give you to this point.
Well, there you go. No disasters. I'm sure there'll be some bits that were funny. There always are with kids' nativities, right? At that age.
I guess you just have to be careful because when you watch it with them, maybe we watch it without them first, because if you sort of have a chuckle, you don't know how sensitive they are. You know, they say their line, you laugh, you think, oh, that's really sweet. They might be like, oh, what's wrong? Why are you laughing? So I think we're going to have to, do you know what I mean? Because parents just say, oh, isn't that lovely? And they're like, Mom. So might have to do a little sneaky watch before I watch it with them.
Well, good. And I'm glad he overcame the nerves.
Yeah, he said, yeah, it was good. And that was it. And I was like, okay. And I'll obviously confirm it when I watch the performance. But we got a message today from Alina on Twitter. And she said she saw a poem that reminded her of the discussion that we'd been having about nativity.
Oh, nice.
It's called Rolls and it's by Brian Bilston. And here we go for you. He never got to play the part of Joseph. He was one of those kids nobody noticed. It's quite a sad poem, actually,
just
say.
It's a rough start.
Bit sad. Yeah, he hasn't started well, has it? The type barely seen and more rarely heard. No innkeeper, Herod or second shepherd. So I feel a bit better because I had a first shepherd and a first wise man. Not once did he wear the crown of a king nor the wings of an angel, although he could sing. Instead, he would be brown cow number four, a rock or a bauble, or the stable door. I mean, that's the worst job right there, the stable door. All these years later, it still made him wince, for it seemed that his life hadn't changed that much since.
Oh, I think the rock is way worse than a stable door, because at least a stable door you might have to move.
No, but a stable door, someone is actually going to have to open you to get in.
You have some sort of direction.
No,
a rock just sit there.
I think a bauble's quite nice because you might be shiny.
You could dress up nicely.
Dress like a shiny bauble.
Yeah.
I think a rock you could just chill out on the stage, but a stable door. No, I'm sorry, but if you went home, if your little fella, if Roger in a few years comes home and says, Mum, I'm a stable door. Yeah. I mean, you're going to be proud of him because he's in it, but
I won't. Stable door.
Rock. Actually, you know what? I think it's a toss up between a rock and a stable door as to the part possibly you don't want your child to be, despite the fact you'll still be proud of them. But no, it was, Alina, thank you for the poem. It's quite a sad poem. But nativity went well. And when I finally get the link, that I keep being told I'm going to be sent a link, I'll let you know how it turned out.
Brilliant.
Yeah, so we're going to report back.
I'm pleased.
It's meant to be the off season in tennis. And normally during an off season, there's a lot more ish than tennis. Because there's no tennis. There is a ridiculous amount of tennis. I mean,
yeah.
It's, and largely to do with the season that we didn't really have this year because of COVID, and trying to make plans, which as we record this on Tuesday are still unconfirmed, for some kind of season, at least for the first part of next year.
Yeah, I've given up making plans, but I think that's mainly because I've got a newborn and plans are not a thing. Times are not a thing.
Yeah, no, you don't worry about plans or schedules or tournaments. But as again, this is all unconfirmed. I think it was put out in L'Équipe. A journalist from L'Équipe put out the early ATP schedule. Then Open Court Steph Miles did a piece on the WTA schedule and how they're going to kind of mesh and where they're going to be. And what we know is, well, unconfirmed, what we know is that off Auckland, Pune, New York, Rio and Indian Wells off.
All gone. Sounds like a lot, doesn't it? But some of those were happening at the same times, I believe, or maybe not. Or maybe it covers a longer period of time than I'm imagining. Yes. So it's the provisional, I'm going to call it provisional because it's not entirely confirmed or set in stone, yep, because nothing is. But that takes us up to basically the beginning of Miami. So we don't know about Miami moving forward, I believe. I haven't heard anything about Miami.
I heard someone say that Miami might be Miami, but played not in Miami. So therefore, I'm not sure how it could be Miami.
Oh, Cincinnati and New York style.
Yeah, nice. A little bit. They might just move it to a different country altogether.
Well, that would be...
I think it would be a stretch to still call it Miami at that point.
Yeah. I think Miami in Belgium.
Yes, it's just very confusing. So the provisional, it's much better than my unconfirmed, would be, and this is ATP, would be Delray Beach would kick things off beginning of January. Then you would have the ATP Cup, I imagine a slimmed down version, and an ATP 250 the week before the Australian Open that would start the 8th of February. And then following that, we've got Montpellier, Cordoba, Rotterdam, Buenos Aires, another new 250, Doha, Marseille, Santiago, Acapulco and Dubai. And that takes us up to, what, mid-March. I mean, anything can happen, anything can change. It's good, though, and it's important, isn't it? For you as a player, you need to know, even if there's a chance it could change, you need to know roughly what you're kind of looking at, right?
Yeah, definitely. Well, remember, a lot of nations need visas for places as well. So if they're sort of changing schedules last minute, that can be slightly difficult. I mean, of course, they're pretty good at it. But yeah, I think the important thing, and it seems like this is what they're doing, is to get the 250s on, to get that level of tournament on. Because that's what's going to support the players as much as possible. And also, if you only have, say, one on, it's just going to be absolutely nails because everybody's going to play it. So yeah, it just seems like they're, you know, if the Grand Slam goes ahead and then they just get on as many 250s as possible, that is probably the minimum, I suppose, they would be hoping for. But as I say, you don't know.
Australian Open qualifying to happen in Dubai.
Right.
So that will happen in Dubai and then the qualifiers will then fly to Melbourne to go into the quarantine with the players who have already qualified. And then I think, they're saying maybe five or six will be added to that in case you get the people that drop out, your lucky losers.
Oh, so there will be some lucky losers on site this time.
It's amazing, isn't it? We're reading so much. A lot of this is coming through social media.
I'm just letting
media.
You talk because I've become a bit lost.
And normally I just sort of throw this to you and sort of let you sort of piece this together. Now I'm piecing it together for you. And this is made up of lots of different reports from lots of different people from lots of different sources. But the latest on this was that qualifying would take place in Dubai. They would then get on that plane all together, fly and go into the little sort of lockdown quarantine hotel. And there would be a handful of lucky losers.
Right. Yes. So qualifying taking place when? A couple of weeks before, right? Because they've got a quarantine.
Yes, and that would it's full qualifying in Dubai.
Yeah,
it will all. Whoever came up with this, they deserve a pat on the back. They deserve a large drink. They deserve whatever they want because it's so complicated even to talk about. But it's absolutely incredible that this is coming together. I mean, how many people does this involve in terms of tournaments either moving, making way completely, new tournaments starting, flights from the Middle East over to Australia to put people in a hotel to quarantine to get a Grand Slam to take place.
Yeah, it's impressive, isn't it? But yeah, it'd be great to have the qualifying, of course. You know, it's another group of players. I say this all the time. You know, they are in a really tough spot, those sorts of rankings between 100 and 250. So to try and look after them, and especially because there are fewer tournaments, it's not like they're going to be getting into those sort of 250 events. So it's really important. So I'm really pleased to see that. And it kind of seems to make sense, but it feels quite radical, doesn't it, qualifying in Dubai?
Do you think it's the bit that makes sense is temperature-wise? Because you wouldn't want something to happen if they had to go somewhere a lot cooler and then turn up in Australia and you've got the Australian summer. So you need to do it somewhere, A, where COVID is managed, controlled or not existent, and B, somewhere in terms of a temperature that it's not a massive shock to the system when the players then turn up in the Australian summer.
Yeah, I suppose they will have a couple of weeks, won't they, to adjust in Australia. But yeah, absolutely, they would all want to be training, doing their off season in hot countries. We've got lots of players out in Dubai already. We've got players training at, you know, in all sort of course Monte Carlo, very popular place, lots of players live there. So you know, players trying to get, although Monte Carlo is not going to be that hot, to be fair, but players will be trying to get the sun, get the heat, get prepared as early as possible. So yeah, I mean, it seems to suit, doesn't it, Dubai? I mean, it's something that I can't say I would have ever thought of that as like an option if I was part of the team trying to figure things out. But yeah, it seems quite radical, but like it will work.
Yeah, I'd say it's incredible. Whoever came up with the idea and the fact that they're going to piece this all together and when it is confirmed is, well, it's a phenomenal feat. I know things can change and are still changing. I mean, as we speak, where you live, you've just gone into tier three, which means are you yep, pretty locked in, locked down, locked up?
Tier three's, yeah, fairly strict. Although, I mean, it's not really. I mean, restaurants and bars and stuff are closing, but they're keeping everything else open. So schools are open, shops are open, that sort of thing. You just, no household mixing, just stricter rules on that sort of thing. So I think we start tomorrow, Wednesday.
Right, okay. So you've got a little bit of free. We're staying in tier two, which means for those listening outside the UK that where I am, we can meet in groups of six in, say, a garden, and restaurants and bars are open. And if you're freelance, you can actually have a business meeting in a restaurant, if you see what I mean. Yeah. So yes, you can actually, yes, eat with someone from outside your household in a restaurant. I mean, the rules change the whole time, and apparently they're going to change again as we head into Christmas, when it sounds like it's a bit of a free-for-all for 5 days over Christmas, and then we will see what happens after that. But in terms of tennis, they're piecing it all together. But one bit of news, one person who came out this week who was having a little bit to say is Roger Federer, because initially people thought he would be ready and all set for Australia, having missed the majority of this year with his knee problem. He's now said, and he was speaking at the Swiss Sports Awards, which incredibly, he was voted best Swiss male sportsman of the last 70 years.
Oh, is that was a thing, was it?
Yeah, but it was actually of the last 70 years, not ever, not in recent times, but it was a very specific.
Was there someone amazing before that?
Yeah, I'm just wondering what happened. You do wonder what happened 70 years ago. But he went to the awards and he was asked about a number of things afterwards, and it was just interesting some of the things he was coming out and saying. He said that the knee wouldn't be ready for Australia. He wants to get
No, they've even delayed it for him, come on.
But and it's sort of, and you sort of think, look, if the knee's not quite right, he's in his 40th year, there's all this sort of quarantining bits and pieces, it's I can see why the decision was probably made. It's not the ideal circumstances in which to return.
Yeah, and well, it'll be a full year, right? Full year out.
Yeah.
No matches, yeah, by the end of the Australian Open.
And he said he's prioritising Wimbledon, the Olympics and the US Open.
Fair enough. Pretty big tournaments.
So that's going to be...
Makes sense.
His 2021 aim. But then he said, I hope that I'll find the courts again in 2021. So this is a quote from Federer. We'll see. But if my career ends here, that's just a big statement in itself. Well, it would be incredible to end it with this reward.
Oh, wow. Oh, no. He's whipping everyone up into a frenzy, isn't he?
Is this the first time... I mean, he said a while back that he had no plans of retiring. He wouldn't be retiring in 2021. But is this the first time we're hearing him talk like this? Whether it is the knee, whether it's just a year out, that he's had time to think and assess things, whether... I don't know. It just... I feel that for the first time, it's a very real possibility that, that next year could be as last year.
Yeah, I think so. I think this is clearly something really significant, a full year out, and he still doesn't even know whether he's going to be ready. I mean, it might be later on. It might not be till the summer. As he says, it might not be at all in 2021. So it's just one of those things that he's got to manage, and maybe it's just more difficult to recover from than he anticipated. If you think back to, say, Andy Murray with his hip, I know it's a totally different situation. He was much younger, but he just didn't recover from the surgery like he expected to and like others had. Everything just slowed down, took longer and was incredibly frustrating, had to have more surgery, that sort of thing. So you just don't really know. But I mean, I don't think, if we had a full year out from Federer, I don't know if we have, because we had the back injury we've had significant injuries over the past sort of 5 years or so, yeah. But to do a full year and then and then look to try and come back. If he's not 100%, that's pretty tough going. Good news is he'll still have a ranking. He'll still be ranked, which is pretty new. So I'm sure he will try his best. But it's just a guessing game at this point, isn't it? But yeah, it does sound like it's going to be a tough one to come back from. And as he says, it'll be a bonus if he can.
It's such an interesting time. I think the pandemic and the time away from the sport, even for those players who have a full life post-tennis. So you know that when they hang up the racket, there is so much that they can do and that they will do. I think it must be, I don't know if this came into it at all with you, but even for the players like a Nadal or a Federer who've had such a full career and continue to have one, it must still be or still have been slightly terrifying thinking about life not travelling and not playing tennis. And it feels like what the pandemic's done with that enforced break is made them realise that it's not so bad, and that life without travelling, playing tennis every day, yes, they still love it, but then they also love the things they've been doing when there hasn't been any tennis, almost preparing them in a way for life after tennis.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's probably relevant for a lot of players.
Yeah.
I always find, and it's the same at any stage, if somebody's thinking about stopping, whether it's that they're at the end of their career, whether it's because they want to have a family, whether it's because they're injured, or whether they just have maybe fallen out of love with the sport. I mean, all of these things are reasons. You know, I always think that the biggest way to resolve it is to have that break. And then see what the other life is like, see whether you are actually ready to retire or whatever it is. I mean, with an injury, you have less choice about it, to be fair. but with the other ones, if it's sort of a mental or emotional thing, it's have a look and see. And you never know, you might actually love your life outside of tennis and you might be really excited by it. Or you might think, actually, I miss tennis so much. I mean, look at Ash Barty. I mean, look what she did. I mean, it's so brave to do that, to take that time out, to go and play cricket, to go and live her life in a different way. And she realised, actually, if I change my mentality, if I get back into tennis, tennis is what I love to do. I mean, she's got the burden of being ridiculously talented at so many different things. So, you know, tough to make a decision when you have that many options. But, you know, and she came back and she clearly now loves tennis and, of course, is number one in the world. So, you know, that's an example. And I say it a lot to parents as well, of children, when they come to me and say, oh, they don't want to play anymore. And I'm like, let them have a few months or however long they yeah. need. Let them go the summer without competing and see what summer is like without competing. Because I tell you what, it can be unbelievably boring. And sometimes you just don't know that. And then you go and you suss it out and then you might come back to it or you might not. And either way, I think the outcome is going to be the right one.
Here's a question for you. Will 2021 be Roger Federer's last season on tour?
Oof. I don't know. When did you first ask that question? 2016?
I feel I've been asking that for quite a few years. But with these comments and with the knee that seems to have dragged on, and I think probably that the break with the pandemic just gave him that little bit of extra time in terms of, right, you know, I'm not going to rush this and et cetera, et cetera. Now I'm not going to Australia, and he's prioritizing, as we said, Wimbledon, the Olympics and US Open. But I just, there's a few more things coming out now. I don't know. And there'll be Roger Federer fans saying, no, he's never going to retire. But the truth is, and I just don't want to burst anyone's bubble, but he is going to retire one day, and he is in his 40th year, and the injuries are starting to come a lot more frequently than they did. So I will say that I think 2021 will be his last season on tour.
I mean, I don't think he wants to be in a situation maybe similar to, say, Andy Murray, with injuries, it being sort of off and on, trying again. And I'm not saying that because Andy's doing it wrong or anything like that. It's just purely because Federer's a lot older. It's just, he just doesn't have the time to do that. Whereas Andy could say, right, I'll spend two or three more years trying to get back and trying to get more consistent with being able to play at that level. You know, his body just keeps breaking down. But for Federer, I think if that were the situation, if he tried to come back and then the knee was still a problem or something else flared up or whatever, I can't see him sort of trying again and again and again and again. I think that would probably spell the end of his career. So I don't know. It's just a guessing game, isn't it? It's tough to say. I don't know whether I have ever fallen into the trap of saying that this might be Federer's last year. I think I may have done it with other people. but I'm going to be confident in that and say that I don't think I've ever said it's his last year, because a lot of the talk has not been about his body, but it's been about his form and the fact that he not winning slams, for example. But last year's Wimbledon final, come on. He nearly won it, to be fair. It's not like he's losing in the third round. Yeah, I think the conversations before I've always sort of brushed off because it's just basically been like, well, what's the point of him playing if he's not going to win any more Grand Slams? And I would say, well, that's ridiculous. He absolutely could win more Grand Slams. And also, I think he just enjoys playing and winning because he still wins a lot, even if you lose the last match, right? So, I don't think I've ever said he's going to stop. It seems fairly likely this could be his last year.
I'm not going to get an answer, am I?
Well, I don't know whether he'll even play. I don't know. I mean, who knows how bad the knee is?
Oh, right. Okay, so he could have had his last year, is what you're saying.
Maybe. That's what he said.
Ooh.
Yeah, he did. They were his words. You can't have a go at me for that. I've not plucked that out of thin air.
So we don't know. I've kind of taken the leap. And
what do you
think? Maybe next
year. You think it is?
I think so. Look, it's, we've been talking about this for so long. It just seems a few more things he's been saying. And I think this break has made a lot of people think, whatever stage of their career they are at, it's made them think, it's made them realise, if I stay at home from it, it's not that bad. And I've got other things going on. And if I'm not travelling every week, it's not the end of the world, because it's something they've done for years. And I think it's changed the perspective a little bit and made them think, when I finally do hang up the racket professionally, actually life's pretty good, even if it looked pretty good anyway. I think that being forced to stop playing and not allowed to, injury or the pandemic, I think that it's changed a few things possibly. So yes, I will say that next year, I apologise to Federer fans, will be his last year.
Yeah, I think it's interesting, isn't it? Because tennis players only, if they did an off-season at home, they'd only ever get 6 weeks. It's a weird amount of time, because it's not like you can sort of do a lot of stuff, because obviously you're training and you're going to have a holiday and a break in there as well, and catch up with some people. But it's the amount of time that can be sort of fairly boring. And if you're injured, you're rehabbing all day, every day. And you cannot underestimate how boring rehabbing is. It doesn't matter what injury you've got, to be doing that all day, every day, it is so tedious that it will just drive you to distraction. So I think that actually, I think when people first stop, the 6 weeks you kind of, you're used to, and then that becomes a couple of months, it becomes a few months, and you start to sort of drift and you're not necessarily sure what you're doing, what your direction is. And that can become quite tough for people. But then once you go past that, and if you know you've got a block of time, then you can start getting things in place a little bit more. So I think with people having so much time this year, you can start getting into routines. You can find out what you like, and start getting your life sort of in shape away from the court. And it sort of forms something that you can grip onto and go, okay, yeah, actually, that's all right.
We had a question from Nat, who did say, "Happy holidays to you both."
Hey, Nat.
It was, "Hiya, gals. I was wondering if Naomi knows much about the whole system of patrons investing in players at a young age and then taking part in earnings later in their career. How would that whole thing transpire, and at what age? How many players actually go on to have careers worth the investment? And isn't it a lot of pressure for a youngster?" And, I mean, there's a lot of questions in here from Nat. And the final one is, "How common is it?" And I think this is a really interesting subject to talk about. And it's something that we don't often hear a lot about. There's a few, I find players from Asia, if they win a title, they might thank their sponsor in the speech and thank someone who has been backing their career. But it's not something I find that we often talk about.
No, it's actually not. I mean, we talk a lot about federations, you know, in the Grand Slam nations, particularly the rich federations, that's ultimately sponsoring kids. But I mean, at the end of the day, tennis is an expensive sport to play as a professional, and it costs everybody pretty much the same amount of money. So, you know, we have a thing in the UK, I'm sure we have it in the States and in France and in Australia, where people think that money's handed out too easily and that kids are spoiled, and that means that they're not driven. Well, it costs the same amount of money for everybody to play, whether you have a federation or not. You either get your money from a federation, you either get it from your family, your parents, because you're rich enough, or you get it from a private sponsor. That's they're basically the three options in terms of travelling. And that has to start happening from a fairly young age. So the private sponsors, the patrons would probably work with agents. So agents, you know, part of their job is to be a talent scout, a talent spotter, to sign people up young. They go to Orange Bowl, which has just happened last week. They go to the TARBS, for example, which is a European event. It's an under 14 event for some of the top European players. So, you know, Nadal has played there, Djokovic, you know, all those sorts of players. And they spot the talent. And it's not necessarily the ones who win, although they tend to gravitate towards the ones who win. But also, you know, the ones that perform well. And you know, they will be out there. They will be hands-on. They'll be chatting to people, chatting to coaches. They will have coaches they trust as well. So you sort of, yeah, they might clump together. You have an agent who has a coach that he trusts in terms of spotting talent. And then also has, you know, a patron who is willing to put money in to do that. So that's where it would start, probably about the age of 12, 13, I imagine, is when they would start taking them on. But really from whenever the player starts looking like somebody who might be professional. And then wasn't that interested in terms of how it works, like, financially?
Yeah, well, I'd be interested in how it works
financially. Well, so they'll do some sort of lump sum per year. Potentially, I mean, everybody will do it differently, whatever works for them, but it will normally be I'll give you X amount each year. Once you are in the top 100 or top 50, you can pay me back by way of percentage of your prize money. Some patrons will just do it for the fun of it, and they'll say until you've paid back all of the money I've given you. Others will say until you've paid back all the money I've given you plus 20%. And others, depending on their situation, will just say it will be 10% for the rest of your career, and that's it. And I'm just hoping you can win Wimbledon, because that'll be lovely. Yeah, there are all different sorts of ways you can do it. I personally know a patron who would only want their money back, and they're just doing it because they want to be involved with that player. They want to help that player. And they've been involved with a number of successful players and has done a fantastic job, again, working with an agent and a coach in terms of that team. Because also, if you're putting money into somebody, and also if you're an agent of somebody, it's important that you get good coaching on board. You can't just let them work with whoever they want to. You're invested in them, aren't you? So it can work in any one of those ways, but it's absolutely huge by way of private sponsors. It's not particularly big, as I say, in the rich countries like the UK, like the States, the ones that have the slams, because the money comes from the federation. But as I say, if you get $100,000 from the federation, or you get $100,000 from a private sponsor, I mean, it doesn't make any difference. Maybe you have less responsibility to the federation, but you don't really.
How much say would a patron have in terms of if they have invested all this money? Do they have a say in your coach? Would they turn up to training sessions? Would, you know, how involved actually are, and they might be a fan of tennis, but they might know nothing about tennis in terms of the technical side of things, the coaching side of things, but their money is what is keeping this player going. So how much say would they have?
Yeah, I just want to say that if you can hear the grunting, that is that's the baby. So, sorry about that. But he's just joining in. He's agreeing. So in terms of the say that they would have, again, I think it's just individual. I mean, some, as I say, if you're the sort of person that wants to, the contract you have would be to get your money back, for example, then that is just somebody that really wants to help. He's clearly passionate about the sport, believes that they can help, and just wants to be involved. So that is the sort of person that will be sort of just supporting, wanting to come and watch matches, you know. So you're obviously, you know, if you're playing at Wimbledon, you're probably going to get him some tickets to come and
it'd
watch.
It'd only be
you.
Fair, wouldn't it?
You know, that sort of thing. So yeah, and I think they just want to make sure that everything's okay and that you're working with the right people. And you know, if you're somebody that wants to ultimately, you're seeing it as an investment and you want to, you know, make some money out of it at the end of the day, then you're probably going to be a little bit more particular. But you know, I've seen it work in all ways. I mean, there are plenty of players that have private sponsors that end up not being professional tennis players and get stuck, just like everybody else, just like players who get funded by federations. It happens all over the places. They're no different. But, you know, I suppose when it comes to an independent sponsor, you need to thrash everything out at the beginning, just understand what both sides want from it, because it will be a long-term contract. You know, but I've seen it work absolutely brilliantly well. And, you know, they absolutely love it as well. That's the thing, is I think for the most part, they just really want to be involved. And also they get the perk of being able to go to the tournaments to watch, right? So they get to go and watch their player, be associated with them and really enjoy the journey with them, which is a fantastic thing. They're part of the team. They're a huge part of the team.
And you'll get patrons that will sponsor more than one. They might take a group of players, invest in a group of players, not just one player.
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, if you invest in three players heavily, then the chances that one of them pops, because, you know, look, potential is potential. You know, it's very difficult to tell who is actually going to do well in the end. So if you kind of, yeah, if you go for, say, three different players, you know, men, women or boys, girls, different ages, just whoever, you know, people think or that you think really is worth it. I mean, the biggest thing is the work ethic. They're not going to have it if you're not working hard. That they're just pouring money into you. If you're not going to be trying in all of your matches, and if you're going to tank here and there and just roll over and whatever, they're not going to be happy with it. Or if you're injured all the time, they're going to be saying, well, can we not sort this out? Like, you need to compete. But all of that is what a good coach would be doing, or what the federation would be doing if they were funding you as well. So it's absolutely no different. A financial sponsor is a financial sponsor, whichever way you cut it, really.
But Nat asked, she said, isn't it a lot of pressure for a youngster? And I think I would feel more pressure if the money was coming from an independent patron rather than a federation.
Interesting. Why is that? Just because the federation, it's almost the view is that they're supposed to do it.
A little bit that the federation, that is why they are there, that is why I would go to them. But if it's an individual who is putting in their own money because they've seen something in me, not to say I wouldn't want to fight and work hard for the federation, but I think I would feel maybe it'd work on the flip side, that I would work harder if it was just someone who loved their tennis who wanted to invest in me. But I think I'd feel a little bit more pressure that this person's hard-earned money is going on me as an investment, and I would feel that pressure to succeed to pay them back.
Yeah, I think so, but it's also their choice to get involved, and it's their, you know, it's normally not a huge amount of money for them. You know, these people tend to be very wealthy and just have a passion for tennis and want to help people. I personally think that the most pressure would be if your parents were paying for it. So say, you know, your parents, because, you know, you have all these stories. So like when I was young, you know, my mum took on a second job and worked at weekends, and she was working 7 days a week to be able to pay for my tennis, and, you know, all those sorts of things. You know, the sacrifices that they make every weekend, driving you around to different tournaments, and, you know, no holidays, because all of the money's going into one thing. And yes, tennis is expensive, but it doesn't mean, you know, you have to be absolutely loaded and wealthy to play it. We were fortunate enough that with some sacrifices, we were able to afford it. But that, I mean, I felt huge amounts of pressure.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting. Nat, thank you very much for that question. If you do ever want to get in touch with us with questions, you can do so via Instagram, via our website, which is tennispodcast.com, or Twitter, the tennis account, or Naomi and I are both on Twitter. Now, we've got something happening this week, which I thought you were going to be a part of, but you're not a part of, probably because of the little fella, is we've got an ATP tennis radio end of year quiz. Now, I assumed that you would be part of one of the teams. I looked through the teams And you're not there.
I'm not there. Have you got a good team?
Well, so we've got, see which team, right, which team you think is stronger here.
Okay.
So we've got Team A, which has got myself, Lucy Arl.
That's a rough start already.
Oh. Lucy Arl. Barry Cowan.
Yeah, that's great.
And Seb Lozier. People who don't know, okay, Seb does a lot of work for ATP Tennis Radio, also does a lot of work on rugby. The rugby isn't going to be of any use on this quiz, though, so he's got to have the tennis.
And we should just say Barry Cowan of penis fame.
Yeah, lovely. For people...
we can just leave it there, well, no, if you want. We don't need to explain it. No context.
Right, there we go. There'll be people typing that in Google, won't they? Wondering what they come up with. I wonder if there'll be a question along those lines in the quiz. Team B is Peter Mercato, Brian Clark... It's got the more international feel, this team. Jill Krabis. So somehow we're getting people together from Australia and America and Miles from England and Miles McLagan. So I think, okay, in terms of the competitive team, it is definitely Team B.
Yes, I was going to say, if it comes down to competitiveness, you're going to get walloped.
Yeah, we're going to. I mean, Barry Cowan is... It's very competitive as well, but I think with Peter Mercato in there and Miles, I think that's a very... So which team do you think is stronger? Team A or Team B?
Oh, well, the competitive team. International Team B.
I thought you were going to go with my team, Team A.
No, yes. Sorry.
Ken, I was wondering, if the little fella is asleep, could I cheat? Could I just ask you for answers? Could you Google things for me?
Oh, yes. Marvelous. Definitely.
Lovely.
Definitely far and away. I love cheating on a quiz. It's the best.
Oh, wow. Okay, brilliant. It's Chris Bowers is coming up with all the questions and it's all going to be Zoomed. So I don't know how it's going to work or how it's going to sound and how we can confer with our teammates when we're just all on this thing. But yeah, if you could be to hand, that would be very useful.
Okay, all right, I'll be there. Well, I won't. I might be asleep. But there you go.
Oh, right. Okay.
If I'm awake, I'll help. I don't know what I'm bringing. I don't have the knowledge.
No, but you've got Google, have you?
Oh, that's true. And no one looking at me.
Exactly. So you could Google. I'll have my phone on silent. Together, you can almost be, and if anyone asks, you're just the fifth member of our team. You wanted to be involved, and I found this was a way to get you involved.
Okay, perfect.
Is that a good idea?
I'll just say I was cheerleading. It's fine.
Exactly. And for our, we're going to do a Christmas special of the podcast, but now that you've been plunged into tier three.
Oh, yes.
We won't be anywhere near each other.
No, we stay very, very far apart. You enjoy your tier two freedom.
I'm going to enjoy
although
my,
everything's relaxed over Christmas, so I could come around for Christmas.
Yes, but we'll have done our special by then.
Oh, yeah, true. Yes. That's a terrible idea.
But yes, but you still can come around if you'd like to over Christmas. But if anyone wants to let us know their 2020 highlights, then we'd love to hear. Again, Twitter, website or Instagram. You guys, you are a massive part of why we do this podcast.
The main part. To be honest,
it is actually. I mean, yes, we would, if we weren't doing this podcast, we would still be chatting like this pretty much every day. But this, it's lovely hearing what we hear from the people who listen. So thank you. Let us know your highlights. We're going to keep going through 2021 and we are going to have a Christmas edition for you next week.
Yes.
A socially distanced tennis Christmas special.
Yes. And if you're one behind, I wish you a happy Christmas now.
Oh, mm-hmm. Right. Okay, you're going to do the happy Christmas. I feel that's... I've even got a Christmas jumper this year, first time.
Oh, have you? Oh, I've never seen you in a Christmas jumper.
Well, okay. You might can't just wait do that it. On our socially distanced tennis Christmas party podcast special.
Brilliant. I'll see you then.
It's a bit of a mouthful, isn't it? Right, see you then. Look forward to it. Bye.